Hey everyone, it's me, Jordan from Barbell Medicine, and before we get into this podcast episode, I wanted to take this opportunity to tell you that this weekend only, we're running a special promotion for Father's Day. Take 20% off the entire site this weekend only using code DAD20 at checkout. We have our comprehensive training templates crafted by yours truly to help smash those goals, or you can check out our science-based supplements to help support your training and nutrition. All of our apparel is also on sale, so you can have the most nuanced wardrobe in the gym. Now on a personal note, it is my birthday on June 17th. Yep, another year around the sun and another year with Barbell Medicine. Thank you so much for your support so far. We couldn't have done it without you. The sale ends after my birthday on June 17th. Again, use code DAD20, that's D-A-D-2-0 at checkout to take 20% off site-wide. Discounts cannot be combined with other offers and other exclusions may apply.
Saving money on everything for your next project at Menards. It doesn't matter what job you're up against. Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment have the power for you to get the job done faster and easier. The PowerShare 20-volt batteries run longer on a single charge, and they can be used with other tools. Check out Menards' entire selection of Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment. Plus, the weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Great debates in fitness and in health, episode number 6. Question number 6. This one is about the physical activity guidelines. All right. Now, the first set of physical activity guidelines were published in 1978 by the American College of Sports Medicine, that's the ACSM, where they recommended only cardio. They were updated in 1990 to include resistance training, and the current guidelines recommend a minimum of twice weekly resistance training for all major muscle groups and about 2.5 hours per week of total moderate to vigorous intensity conditioning. Now, a recent study showed that those with a higher genetic risk for obesity needed more exercise to counter their genetics. Additionally, we know that individuals respond differently to exercise. For example, those who have a reduced strength and muscle gain in response to exercise, these are termed non-responders in some studies, well, they seem to benefit from additional training volume, which this leads us to the debate proposition that the current exercise guidelines are adequate for health. Austin, you want to take the lead on this?
Yeah, sure. I think they're fine. Yes, I agree that there's a lot of variation in individual response to training, but population-wide guidelines, it's going to be quite difficult to... It's honestly like not realistic to ask them to deliver individualized prescription to individual person scenarios. You could make an argument that like, hey, maybe in the exercise guidelines, they could lay out, they're like, here's our initial prescription, or at least a way to work up to it. And then based on how you respond by whatever metric they'd have to decide, right? If you are not reaching this level of improvement, then the next step would be to do this. So some kind of algorithm to improve, you know, the individualized response. But I do think that that's probably a bit of a big ask for like nationwide broad physical activity guidelines. But I suppose you could make an argument like that. For the purposes of health, you know, we've looked at this before. We've even talked about it before in previous episodes that I won't go back and recite. But, you know, in terms of like, quote unquote, how strong do you need to be for health? Honestly, not terribly strong. Like, you can get a very modest amount of strength, and you probably are getting the overwhelming majority of strength benefits. Neither of us are under any illusion that we have been accruing additional health benefits by increasing our maximum force production from a 315 deadlift to 405 deadlift to, you know, 700 plus deadlift over the intervening years. That benefit has honestly probably turned in the other direction at some point along the way without us realizing it, whether to our physical health or our mental health along the way. For conditioning, I think that there's a little bit more clear evidence that getting more and more conditioned continues to deliver more health benefits. I feel more confident in that than I do on the kind of strength training aspect of the spectrum. But similarly, there's still kind of diminishing returns. There's substantial benefits from going from very low cardiorespiratory fitness to low cardiorespiratory fitness. There's large benefits from going from low to moderate, and then going from moderate to high or higher to elite. Again, those benefits tend to taper off. And so you could make an argument that like, hey, 2.5 hours a week of, you know, conditioning is unlikely to get you an elite VO2 max or something like that to enjoy that level of health benefit. And so if that is what you're looking for, then yeah, you're probably going to need to do quite a bit more. But we're already dealing with a situation where almost nobody is meeting or exceeding the full set of physical activity guidelines. And so just cranking up the guidelines is no different than just like us getting on, say we had a national TV platform and we just wagged our finger harder at the population and said, eat less and move more. And then when that didn't work, we went back on and we said, eat even less and move even more. Like just escalating your recommendations in the face of most people not necessarily adhering to them is not really going to do much of anything aside from like patting yourself on the back that like, oh yeah, these guidelines are good now, but still nobody's doing them.
Yeah. No, I think your points are well made. And I think if I have to take the negative on this, that the current exercise guidelines are not adequate for health, I have to approach it from three different sort of ways. Way number one is that I think most people, if they're even aware of the guidelines, maybe don't view them in through the correct lens, that they are a minimum level of physical activity guidelines, not an optimal level, if you were to use that phrase. So these are just minimum guidelines. Like, hey, every adult should hit these guidelines to not suffer from insufficient physical activity related sort of disease processes or health issues. That doesn't mean that you're sort of maximizing your health span or lifespan with respect to exercise. And so if I had to adjust the physical activity guidelines, I would say, look, here's the minimum level, and then maybe here's an optimal level or like something to shoot for. So that's kind of like my first issue with the guidelines. The second issue with the guidelines that I would have, that I would argue them not being adequate enough, is that we don't have metrics that are either useful for assessing somebody's response to training or also evaluating individuals' needs. So to your point, yeah, they're general guidelines for a population, so it's really hard to individualize, but we don't even have the evidence there to prescribe this. So for example, we know that there's a dose-dependent relationship between cardiorespiratory fitness and reduction in cardiovascular disease and like all-cause mortality. Great, what VO2 max should we shoot for? If that's the proxy that we have good evidence in, that attaining that through fitness or exercise training will obtain. Same thing for strength. How strong do you need to be? And further, is it just sort of objective, like singular point, like get to this point? Or is it like the curve or the path that you go to? Like, so you're participating in these things and attaining these levels, or you're just participating and working towards these levels. So like having some sort of descriptive stuff there that you can use to prescribe or adjust things would be very useful. So that's my second issue with the guidelines. And then the third issue is that because there's such a low uptake in these things, there's a lack of there's an opportunity for improvement with respect to behavior change counseling, motivational interviewing, also allocating resources to individuals for increased uptake. So all of those things would be my issues suggesting that the current guidelines are inadequate for health promotion. And I think it would be difficult to argue against those things. And I suspect that you would agree.
Yeah, I would particularly like point two, and I alluded to this in my response as well. I really would love for there to be some sort of a clear and validated and useful kind of metric to assess response. But even that needs to be caveated and done very carefully, because, for example, you know, we have boatloads of data on relationship between like hand grip strength and health and risk of death and stuff like that. But if you just said the metric is hand grip strength, then you know, people will become under the illusion that, hey, if I just like train my grip strength and happen to get it to that level, then I'm good. Or you might have somebody who did like maybe a bunch of manual labor in their life and they naturally have some like, you know, stronger grip or something like that. And they're like, oh, I guess I'm, and it's like, well, it's probably a little bit more complicated than that. Maybe how you got there matters. Are you continuing to engage and participate in this activity? So I think having metrics to assess response that are meaningful and don't just become a test to be trained for would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. If I was tasked, if the ACSM called us up and was like, hey, Barbell Medicine Bros, you guys want to weigh in on some physical activity guidelines? We heard your podcast. You're talking all this shit. Why don't you
put up or shut up? Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you help us out? So the way I would do it, I don't actually have a problem with the current guidelines as sort of a minimum threshold. I think those are reasonable based on available evidence. But I would add on maybe a sort of optimal point that's a little higher is probably double the guidelines, meaning four times a week resistance training, you know, and instead of 500 to 1,000 met minutes of conditioning, it would be, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 met minutes of conditioning with some sort of objective benchmarks, whether that's respect to like a 20% increase in VO2 max, a 20% increase in some sort of validated strength test that's probably not a hand grip strength, or whether it's a 1RM leg press, chest press, something like that you can test. I think those things would be where I would add. Although, again, to your point, they would have to be very heavily caveated based on the lack of evidence. So when people ask us, well, how strong should I get? It's like, shoulder shrug. I only know of one or two studies that's maybe investigated this, and it's only in dudes. And it's, you know, to the extent that that is generalizable, I have some concerns there for sure. Same thing with VO2 max. Yes, it's heavily associated, correlated with, health. But what about the percentage improvement? Like, you know, is that the more important thing, going from like a VO2 max of 36, increasing it by 20%, is that better or more important than obtaining a certain number, whether it's 45 or 50 or whatever? So I think there's still gaps to be cleared up here. But yeah, I think there's some problems, but also main problem, as far as I can see, is uptake. And I think to the extent that guidelines would be helpful for increasing uptake, yeah, maybe some opportunities for improvement.
Yeah.
All right. Question number 7. This one is about sugar. So kind of like the carbohydrates one, but a little twist. All right. Dietary intake surveys show an increase of about 240 calories a day for most adults over the last 40 years. The three largest food sources to the increased calorie intake are added fats and oils, added flour and cereal products, and added sugars, about a third for each of these things. And added sugars are defined as sugars or syrups added to foods by manufacturers during processing, during preparation, or individuals adding these items at the table. Sugar is also naturally occurring in many foods like milk and fruit, but a lot of people say, hey, look, sugar's bad for you. So the debate proposition, and I'll lead on this one, is that eating sugar is bad for health. And similar to the diabetes and carbohydrate thing, I think I'm going to have to take the affirmative here, because again, I just default to this thought experiment. Like, if I could snap my fingers today in America and say, yeah, we're going to cut sugar consumption by 50%, and would I predict that to improve health trajectory? I think yes, because I think that would result in overall reduction in calorie intake and people consuming less ultra processed foods and so on and so on. I think, and I suspect that my colleague will maybe add to my thought experiment and say, yeah, but what if you just said less sugar, but the same amount of calories? Do you think that's going to really change trajectory? And I would say probably not, although that is more of a contrived situation, because we know that added sugars, in particular from sugar sweetened beverages, are very weakly compensated for, meaning that if you drink a beverage with 250 calories, mostly from added sugars, you're unlikely to compensate by eating 250 calories less later in the day. You'll just eat more calories overall. So I do think that sugar, when it comes in natural forms, whether it's a dairy product, whether it's fruit or whatever, is, you know, on average, neutral to beneficial to health, probably leaning more towards beneficial in those particular contexts. But eating sugar, as it's most widely consumed in the United States, is from added sugar. And so in that context, in a more practical sense, I do think that consuming a lot of sugar is bad for health. And if I could reduce it, if I could snap my fingers and reduce it, I would. Overall, though, when you look at data on, you know, different dietary patterns, ones with higher levels of sugar, ones with lower levels of sugar, when they're tested under controlled settings, meaning people are getting the same amount of calories, and you look at like weight trajectory or other sort of markers of, different health processes, yeah, people do about the same. So I don't actually think that sugar itself is like, you know, toxic and what should be avoided at all costs. I just think that it portends a worse dietary pattern overall when people consume a lot of sugar, because it mostly comes from foods with added sugars, these ultra processed foods.
I think those are reasonable positions to take, but ones that, as was the case in the previous question, can be argued against in a lot of different ways. The proposition, just eating sugar is bad for health, is such a simple and declarative statement that, from, I suppose, like a logic debate standpoint, you could just find like any exception to this, and that would give you room to reject the premise of like, is there a scenario where eating sugar is not bad for health?
Yeah.
And we mentioned a few of those, like eating it from fruit and dairy products and stuff like that. Not bad for health. Therefore, the premise is invalid. Done. But even outside of that, there's many other kind of contextual factors that are at play here. You know, the context that you're talking about, where there's a ton of added sugars and, you know, causing a ton of harms to health, a lot of that is in the context of either existing obesity or in calorie surplus type scenarios. For example, when they've had patients with fatty liver disease and they're in a calorie deficit type scenario, we see, you know, despite them potentially consuming high amounts of a high carbohydrate diet or even sugar in their diet, with equivalent weight loss, we tend to see pretty dramatic improvements in liver fat content, for example, in that type of a scenario. So kind of the physiology around the sugar intake has a role in terms of how it impacts their health. The scenario where that wouldn't be so much at play with respect to added sugars is, like, I suppose it just isn't great for your teeth in general. That is independent of whether you're in a calorie surplus or deficit. But at the same time, like I said, there are many examples of sugar containing foods that are not inherently bad for health. And so that just it means that the premise needs to be refined a bit more in order to be supported in the case of your argument. It's not so simple as just it's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the argument that's made often, is that, hey, just don't eat any sugar. You know, I'm cutting out sugar, bro. I'm like, I mean, if you're cutting out added sugars, I probably have no, I wouldn't, you know, well, actually, I wouldn't do that. I would just say, yeah, cool, knock yourself out. But when people are like, I'm cutting out all sugars, and then they're like, well, what's a sugar? And like, and then I'm like, yeah, when do you care when it's sugar? Because all carbohydrates that you consume are going to turn into sugar by the time it hits your small intestine. So like, are we saying like no carbs? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about only sugar in the form where it enters your oral cavity? In which case, like, I think it's probably a better, when you're thinking about foods, whether they're health promoting, neutral, or harmful to health, it's probably best to look at this through a lens of like food replacement. So like, what foods are you substituting? Because you don't just give up a food and like nothing else happens. There's compensatory changes. And so I think if you're removing added sugars from the diet and replacing them with more minimally processed or unprocessed foods, that's generally beneficial. But if you're just taking out like naturally occurring sugars in favor of, you know, complex carbohydrates or added fats, I think that's in general a lateral move, potentially harmful in some levels. But yeah, ultimately would not expect a big change there. Austin's nodding in agreement. All right, I'll move it along. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is nearly here, which means that warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them and support your fitness goals with Factor's fresh, never frozen, dietitian approved meals. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service and is much healthier than most takeout meals, which tend to be very high in calories due to both the portion size and the ingredients. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the takeout trap and let Factor do the work for you. Now, Factor has options to help fuel you up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. They're ready in 2 minutes, and they even have protein plus options to make sure each meal has at least 30 grams of protein in it. This summer, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered right to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes, no prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey everyone, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine here. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Now, I've been using Babbel for about 2 months now to learn French. On most days, I open the app and I do a review or a new lesson that's been customized for me. Now, my French isn't that great yet, but the spaced repetition learning is really helping, especially since Babbel's tips and tools are rooted in real-life situations and delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice with what you've learned in the real world. They also have speech recognition technology that helps me with my pronunciation and getting the accent right.
Oui, bien sûr.
Oui, bien sûr.
Je m'appelle Alice.
Je m'appelle Alice. We got a very special offer for our listeners. Right now, you can get 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/barbellpod. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/barbellpod, spelled BABBEL.com/barbellpod. Rules and restrictions may apply. Head over to Babbel today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Saving money on everything for your next project at Menards. It doesn't matter what job you're up against. Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment have the power for you to get the job done faster and easier. The PowerShare 20-volt batteries run longer on a single charge, and they can be used with other tools. Check out Menards' entire selection of Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment. Plus, the weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Question number 8. Good, we could talk about genetics. From the 1970s to now, the obesity rate in the United States has grown from 15% in adults to over 40% in 2021. Multiple changes have occurred during the same time frame. For example, the rise in technology, changes in the food environment, and more. One thing that hasn't changed in this short time, however, is genetics. So the debate proposition is as follows. The obesity epidemic is not caused by genetics because the human genome hasn't changed that much over the last 50 years, despite the increase in obesity. Austin, thoughts?
Yeah, the framing of this question is, it's a very common one. It's also kind of annoying in terms of it saying the obesity epidemic is not caused by genetics. And obesity is an example of a condition, like many conditions and diseases, that are complex, multifactorial, but a lot of it relates to a mismatch between the person's kind of genetic predisposition and the surrounding environment. There are other examples of this in other contexts where somebody might have a condition that sets them up very well in a particular environment, you know, like a basketball player who is genetically selected to be very tall, right? He fits in very well in the environment of a basketball arena. But if you take that same athlete and you put them in, I don't know, what's a gymnastics competition that tends to reward being very small and compact, or a roller skating limbo competition or something like that, where they're just fundamentally going to do abysmally poorly, then they're going to have a significant disadvantage. And if all of society was built around being able to do a roller skating limbo competition, basketball players are going to be viewed as having a quote unquote disease of, you know, tallism that sets them up very poorly, very, very poorly, right? And there's, this is a ridiculous analogy, but it's what I was able to come up with off the dome here. But there's a lot of these things where somebody's predisposition can either be better matched to the environment and the demands, or be more poorly matched to the environment and demands. And so with the way that human genetics have trended over evolutionary history, we are now in a period where they are acutely in like geologic terms, meaning like, you know, over the past couple hundred years, being acute or sudden, very poorly matched to our surrounding environment. And so that leaves us with a couple potential targets if we want to address the issue of obesity. The first is, okay, well, do we want to rewind the clock on the food environment? Do we want to go back to, you know, what the food environment looked like a couple hundred years ago or something like that, where there was no food industry, probably hunger was a lot more prevalent and obesity or overnutrition was a lot less prevalent. Food was harder to come by, food didn't taste as good, things like that. That's one way that would work. That would totally work to address the obesity issue, you know, worldwide. If we are unwilling to make such drastic interventions in the food environment that surrounds us, the only other strategy that we have is to work on the level of the individual. And when we look at individual susceptibilities to development of obesity, upwards of 70% of that susceptibility appears to be explained by genes, the vast majority of which are involved in the brain and brain regulation of things like appetite and satiety and food reward and things like that. And only a minority of them are involved in more peripheral aspects of physiology, like fat storage and insulin signaling and things like that. And so when you grasp that, it becomes readily apparent how fruitless it is going to be to, as I alluded to earlier, just keep wagging your finger at people and telling them to try harder, when people who are dealing with this condition, broadly speaking, this doesn't necessarily apply equally to every single person dealing with it, but broadly speaking, are dealt a genetic hand that is poorly matched to the surrounding environment. No, you know, different than wagging your finger at that basketball player and say, limbo harder. You know, the environment, the world that you are in, is one that your genetic predisposition is not a great fit for. And so that is a great reason why, when we look at all of the available interventions to treat obesity, there are those that address kind of conscious decision making, the cortical brain, the outer part of your brain where you're like awake and quote unquote choosing things, giving people dietary counseling, telling them to just eat less, things like that, by and large have a pretty abysmal track record for generating, you know, sustained benefits in the context of obesity treatment. Whereas subcortical treatments, meaning those that address the deeper circuits of the brain, those genetically wired up things that relate to food reward and appetite signaling and satiety and hunger and things like that, those are the kind of things, like the newest class of obesity medications, the impacts of metabolic bariatric surgery, et cetera, that have many times more dramatic effects on this, overwhelming success in recent years in addressing this issue. And so it all kind of fits from that perspective. Now, I understand that everybody, you know, feels like they are in full control of all of their decision making and their choices on a day-to-day basis, and they work hard and they're virtuous and they choose to go to the gym, you know, but even that is mediated by a lot of non-conscious, you know, oftentimes genetically mediated factors that are beyond your control. You never chose to enjoy, you know, doing the things that you do or to not enjoy things that you avoid, but that's just kind of how you are wired up in your surrounding environment. So sorry to say.
free will versus determinism podcast win. So to be clear, you're taking the affirmative or the negative that the obesity epidemic is not caused by genetics?
I'm saying that the proposition is somewhat nonsensical because it's a two-way street between genetics and environment. You can't isolate one variable of the equation. You could have said the obesity epidemic is not caused by environment because so much of obesity is explained by genetics. You could have framed the proposition in the other way, and it would have been equally nonsensical because it's a match or mismatch between these two things.
So he's taking the negative, so I have to take the affirmative that the obesity epidemic is not caused by genetics.
Yeah, you can take the contrarian Twitter position. Go for it.
Well, so I think that if I had to do this, and it's probably just a cop out, and I maybe, you know, are the people who are really into the formal debate and logic and such, they'd be like, dude, you didn't even answer, you know, argue the right points. But the thing here is that if I have to agree that the obesity epidemic is not caused by genetics, I think I could do that easily. I said, sure, it's caused by the food environment. The genetics have been relatively stable, but the food environment has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. Did a long monologue about, you know, how the food environment has changed over the last 50 years, and temporally it correlates perfectly with the obesity epidemic. And so if I could snap my fingers and go back to the food environment from, you know, 1960s, even that recent, the obesity trajectory would decline. There'd be a lot more food insecurity. There'd be other issues, right? So this is not like all roses at the end. But yeah, I would just say, yeah, it's caused by the food environment because the genetics have been relatively stable. The selective pressures and evolutionary development of these genetics are from a long time ago, and they're mismatched to the modern environment. And I would say, yeah, the genetics have been relatively stable, but the food environment has changed. So there you go. Address the food environment. And people are like, I don't know. The regulations, I don't feel good about that, Feigenbaum. I'm like, hey, man, you asked.
Right.
So this actually leads into our next question perfectly. Great segue. No long prelude for this one. It's pretty much self-explanatory. The debate proposition, which I will lead with, exercise participation would be an easier problem to solve than the nation's dietary pattern. So I'll start with this, and I will respond in the affirmative. I think it would be easier to get more people to meet the current physical activity guidelines than it would be to change the food environment significantly. And as I alluded to in my last answer, I think the food environment is what needs to be changed in order to effectively change the average dietary pattern. I do not think that you can just will people into doing this, shame people into doing this. I don't even think that there's a world where we can widely prescribe GLP-1 receptor agonists or other medications that come down the pike that ultimately, you know, change the dietary pattern on a widely population level. So the other thing here is that there's so many competing interests with respect to the food industry, you know, as far as marketing goes, as far as the, you know, what gets stocked on shelves, what the sort of subsidiaries are, like all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of money at play here, and people, there are competing interests, you know, all the way down. So I think that would be a very difficult problem to solve compared to exercise, which almost no one opposes. No one is like, yeah, exercise is bad for you. Don't do it. Stop exercising. That's bad for you. In fact, it's kind of this weird new thing that's happening on social media in the recent years where people are like, ooh, better get to be careful around this particular exercise or this type of exercise. It's like they're, you know, gatekeeping. It's like, wait, what? Like, nobody has been opposing exercise. Everyone is generally behind this. In fact, even like the food industry, a lot of companies are like support, you know, more activities. They'll fund various groups, various organizations and such. And so I think if you, you know, both problems are difficult to solve, but I can imagine a world where there's more promotion of exercise through industry, through grants, through, you know, a lot of public health initiatives. You know, maybe we have this nationally instituted, you know, out, you know, power hour in the middle of the day where, look, everybody gets time to go exercise, it's publicly funded or whatever. To me, well, that seems like a moonshot kind of idea. It seems more plausible than the food environment changing, you know, all these, you know, multi-million, multi-billion dollar organizations like all signing on to say, yeah, all the stuff we're making is crap. We're not going to market to kids anymore also. And we're going to really, really shape up. That, to me, that seems impossible. But getting more people to exercise while still very, very difficult, admittedly, I think that's an easier problem to solve. You disagree?
I think we might have like a genuine disagreement here.
All right. Yeah, let's do it.
I don't know that I agree with you here. So I definitely recognize the barriers that you describe in terms of the interests at play, the moneyed interests at play in the context of the food industry that would represent barriers to progress compared with really the lack of moneyed interests as it relates to exercise. The counter to this is that when I think about these two sorts of things, some sort of broad intervention to increase exercise adherence consistently compared with broad interventions to, you know, the question framed of like solving the nation's dietary patterns, that's a big kind of thing. But like, let's say making incremental progress on them. Only one of those two, to my knowledge, has like actually been done in any place in the world in terms of like legislation, policy, regulation on food industry. We've talked before, for example, about sugar taxes, which while not solving the problem, had an incremental effect on, say, like, you know, children's habitual intake of sugar sweetened beverages and things like that. And so that's despite a lot of interests, presumably not wanting that kind of thing to happen. And if, you know, there's no aspect of society, health related, dietary related, exercise, or any other like social policy related thing that is solved quickly. Everything in terms of social progress is incremental over time. And so, you know, the way I'm viewing this is like, have there been examples of incremental policy related factors that have been passed through in terms of legislation and impacting, you know, the food industry or policy or, you know, national, you know, intakes of certain things? There are several examples of those things, more of them happening in Europe. I think probably a few, some of them happening here, comparatively speaking, whereas I am not aware of, and I could be just missing something here, but a broad national legislative effort that successfully and effectively dramatically increased, you know, exercise participation. Of course, again, it would be incremental, not sudden and like getting 0 to 100% of the population meeting or exceeding guidelines. But I'm not even aware of something that like incrementally, reliably increased exercise participation efforts on a very broad scale. I might be missing some things, but that's kind of why I'm like a little more skeptical of one than the other.
Yeah. I mean, at a federal level, I'm not aware of either, to be honest, like for either dietary pattern or activity. But on a you know, smaller scale, grassroots, there's definitely been policy change and programs enacted to improve physical activity that have worked. So, for example, there have been infrastructure legislation passed to make places more walkable that increases people's participation in walking. At certain school districts, there have been increases in the amount of time allotted to PE class, for example. Certain corporate and industry funded sort of exercise programs where people are incentivized to exercise regularly, whether it's on the job, you know, at the job. There's maybe gyms at the job. So a number of different things have been implemented that do work on a smaller scale. To your point, and I agree, rolling this out federally or, you know, on a national level, that would be extremely difficult. I think where I'm hung up on is just the opposition to any sort of federal policy change relating to the food environment. That's my real hang up. So I agree with your points that there have been more food environment, diet related sort of programs that have been passed through legislation at a state level or even a smaller level than that when compared to physical activity. But there's so much less opposition that I think if we could generate a bill, you know, for this, I think it would be more accepted only because of the lack of opposition. Right. Now, if you package it with a bunch of other dumb stuff that people that are just controversial or polarizing, well, all bets are off. But I think that there's been some like proof of concept stuff with respect to making communities more walkable, giving people more access to places to exercise and safety in particular. Those things, I think, could be beneficial. And then further, I would say that maybe one of my biggest concerns has to do with what's happening at the school level, you know, for children, as far as like PE participation. Just, you know, it's been dwindling and dwindling and dwindling, and some school districts have fought back and said, no, we're going to actually increase this because we need to. And I think maybe if there was a federal policy where every week we need, you know, kids up until age 18 to participate in 3 hours of activity, exercise, or whatever, I think that is more likely to pass than a federal sugar tax, for example. But to your point, yeah, there's been way more stuff on the food environment at a larger level than that. So maybe this is a source of genuine disagreement. So when people ask, what do we disagree on, and say that Austin is opposing exercise and opposing food environment change.
Yes, I'm famously known to be anti-exercise.
That's right. All right. Last question here on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number 6 with Dr. Austin Barakis. Question 10. We're going to talk about hormones. Hormones. All right. So the endocrine system consists of a number of organs that release chemically active substances called hormones that influence how other tissues and organs function. The human body has dozens and dozens of different hormones that act together in concert to keep you alive and functioning well, regardless of the demands, the environment, etc. With respect to weight management, there are many hormones involved in appetite, feelings of fullness, food behaviors, and more. For example, cholecystokinin and peptide YY are short-term or episodic satiety or feelings of fullness hormones, whereas ghrelin increases appetite during periods between meals. Other hormones like cortisol, insulin, testosterone, and so on have been suggested to influence weight management, among many others. The debate proposition that Dr. Austin Baraki will lead: doctors and other members of the medical establishment are bad at helping patients achieve clinically significant weight loss because they don't take into account hormones. Austin, what say you?
This is a cringe. I am curious. I mean, I'm generally familiar with some of these sorts of claims, but what I'm more curious about is the people who make these kind of claims. What exactly are they proposing should be the standard practice when approaching obesity in terms of what does it mean to, quote, take into account these hormones? For example, cortisol. What exactly are they recommending? Are they recommending that I measure it? Okay, let's say I measure it. First of all, that's a very complex hormone to measure in terms of timing and various other sorts of factors that affect its interpretation. But then I'm imagining the scenarios. What if it's a little higher than I want it to be? What are they suggesting that I do about that? What if it's a little bit lower than I, quote unquote, might want it to be? What are they suggesting that I do about it? I would be interested to have a conversation with these folks and actually kind of really grill them a little bit on their propositions and their understanding of these systems and what sorts of interventions they feel would provide superior effectiveness in the context of obesity management. Insulin is another one. A lot of recommendations to measure insulin levels. It's like, okay, let's say we measure it and it's a little high. Maybe indicate if it's, say, a fasting insulin level, it's a little high. And that can be associated with a degree of insulin resistance. What specifically are you going to do differently, having measured that level, to facilitate long-term successful weight loss? They might say, oh, well, now I'm going to put you on a lower carbohydrate diet or something. It's like, okay, well, now I need to see evidence that putting somebody with insulin resistance on a lower carbohydrate diet compared to an equivalent calorie, you know, restricted diet that's formulated differently leads to the leaps and bounds better long-term weight loss outcomes than you think doctors are currently able to achieve. Same thing with testosterone. I could go through each of these. Testosterone very often is low in men with obesity because of a phenomenon of obesity-related secondary hypogonadism. Does that mean that we just throw all of them on testosterone? Well, there might be some untoward effects of such a strategy. And if you are somebody making those kind of arguments, I trust you would be a fan of quote-unquote treating the underlying cause and not symptoms. Low testosterone in the context of obesity, the vast majority of the time, is a symptom, not the underlying cause. And only in a very small minority of cases is the hypogonadism the quote-unquote cause that would be resolved with restoring normal testosterone levels. In fact, when we facilitate weight loss, I've seen testosterone levels that were low rebound to normal with weight loss by whatever mechanism. you know, by just lifestyle habits, with the use of medications, with the use of surgery, et cetera. And so endocrinology is very complex. It requires dedicated study and training, especially when it comes to knowing what the hell you're doing when you're measuring these levels, testing them, interpreting them, and very importantly, acting upon them. And so people who make these kind of claims, I would really like to see straightforward evidence showing that when I measured this hormone and did this action as a result of that finding, it led to more people having successful long-term weight loss than had I not done that and just prescribed, you know, the same sort of lifestyle intervention or the same sort of medical surgical treatment or something like that. None of that exists for literally any of these hormones. And so I'm quite dismissive of this concept. I do not discount the idea that hormones are related to the pathogenesis of obesity, right? Meaning that they're involved in how obesity comes about, especially with the hormones you mentioned, with appetite and feelings of fullness and ghrelin and CCK and PYY and all those kind of things. For sure, they're involved. But I don't need to measure or act specifically on those hormones in any sort of unique way in order to more successfully facilitate weight loss outside of the interventions that we already know are effective for it.
Can you imagine like a hormone-directed weight loss approach? Like, do you know the type of traffic we would get to the website and the type of, you know, clientele we'd be attracting? Like, we could make hundreds of thousands of dollars just being like, look, we're going to, instead of focusing on calories, instead of focusing on behaviors, you know, relating to calorie intake, macros, whatever, we're going to focus on hormones. So we got to sell you this testing panel on the initial point, and then every step of the way, we're going to be managing your diet based on your hormonal response, ignoring everything else. And they're like, yeah, hormones. I don't know enough about those things, so it's got to be legit. It's kind of interesting. So if I'm forced to take the affirmative here that the reason why doctors are historically bad at achieving clinically significant weight loss in their patients is because they don't know, they're not taking into account hormones, I think the only way that I can argue that this is true is because there is a lack of knowledge with respect to neurohormonal signaling at the level of the brain with respect to appetite, satiety, and how these things change over time and how this is happening on a subconscious level. Meaning that I think most physicians, when they're prescribing weight loss or recommending weight loss or whatever, they put far too much importance on personal responsibility and just like, hey, yeah, just you should eat a little bit less, you know, and here are some options to do so. Rather than saying, you know, most of these food-related behaviors, food-related decisions are occurring at a subconscious level. And if they understood that sort of neurochemistry, the hormones going on up there, perhaps they would take a different approach, focusing on changing the microenvironment, whether it's at home, whether it's at the job, whether it has to do with skills related to food preparation, other things that, you know, may lead them down a different path of management. So I could argue that, and I don't actually think you disagree. So I'll just pat myself on the back for that one. But
yeah, I think that's a fair point, that it that's more of like an appreciation that hormones that are not under your conscious control have a role to play in obesity, which is a different proposition than like this should be hormone directed obesity.
Yeah, hormone directed obesity, right? Management. Yeah.
The most extreme example of which that I can imagine would be like putting somebody on something to like completely block all insulin signaling, or like get a pancreatectomy, and then you'll rapidly lose weight. You'll also die very quickly from something like that. But it would be effective for weight loss.
Yeah, I mean, this even goes as far as like leptin, right? So this hormone that everyone thought like, wow, this is it. This is our hormone of interest. You know, leptin goes up as fat stores go up, and it's thought like, okay, well, look, that should prevent people from eating food. It's supposed to be a satiety hormone. That's what it was thought. And so it's like, well, wait, if individuals with obesity have super high leptin levels, this hormone, and this was like kind of well established, well, why are they not eating less? They're like, oh, well, it's leptin resistance. They must not be able to respond.
They need even more. Yeah.
20 something years of data on this, including like metreleptin supplementation in individuals with obesity, like has been shown that leptin effectively is not a very powerful satiety hormone. Rather, when its levels are low, it is an appetite stimulating hormone. That's
you
its
get
main
ravenous.
Function.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Outside of like very, I think there's a genetic condition where people have like a leptin receptor deficiency or something like that, mm-hmm. and treat them with metreleptin. But yeah, so it's like, look, we've been down this hormonal road before. But we did it. We like we went there before you. So I think some of this is like just the mysticism around hormones. Like, yes, to your point, endocrinology is super complex, requires dedicated training. And like, you're not just focusing on one hormone, but like the entire hormonal milieu, as it were. And then like, it's more complicated. But if you maybe don't have that training, then you're like, dude, hormones are so important. Like, why are we missing this? We're like, yeah, no, we got it. But as far as it changing what we do based on those hormones, that's where you're going to have to come up with some receipts. Receipts in this case being evidence.
Yeah, it reminds me of a line that I said many, many, many times during our Huberman Takedown podcast. It's something that sounds good if you don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like individual, like I recently, it's been, this is a slight tangent, but I listened to a swimming podcast recently, which was a new experience for me, because when I was in swimming, podcasts were not really a thing that were popular to do or listen to. I didn't know anything about them. I didn't know that any existed. So this was like the first time I'd listened to a swimming podcast ever. And they had their like little ad breaks. And during some of the ad breaks, it was fascinating because you hear the same kind of like, you know, pseudo scientific like marketing BS, but towards swimmers talking about like hyper individualized precision nutrition to do this. And I'm just like, okay, well, I guess this stuff is, you know, prevalent all over the place. And they made it, I was like, listen to it. I'm like, damn, if I didn't know anything about this, this would sound phenomenal. Right. But that it's just so prevalent in health related topics that you can say things that sound sciencey and fancy and sound compelling. If you don't know what you're talking about, you might buy into it. We would love for obesity to be so simple as just like manipulating a little hormone level. I could make whatever hormone I want, whatever I want it to be. Right. Yeah. I can manipulate your hormone. Is that going to fix it? If it fixed it, that would be incredible. It'd be so elegant and simple and easy. It's not.
Yeah. Well, what I would do is I would take the hormonal data from GLP-1 receptor agonists or similar. You know, it's like, oh, what does this do to like leptin, ghrelin, you know, CKK, PYY, agouti-related peptide, like all these, you know, neurohormonal mediators. Like whatever those changes are on average, that's what I want to do. And so how am I going to do it? I'm just going to give you the GLP-1 receptor agonist because right. That's the best way I know how to do that.
Yeah, or yeah. get you metabolic surgery. And all your hormones are now going to be fixed within a matter of days afterwards, which is what we actually see.
Yeah. Like, do you think, what if we branded like this hormone mediated approach and it was just like, yeah, take the med, do the surgery, because that's how you're going to fix all the hormones. Easiest way to do it.
There you go. Think, problem solved.
Yeah, there you go.
Again, we'll makes sense if you don't think about it.
That's right. All right. A little longer. Again, you can look at the runtime. We went overboard, but hopefully you guys enjoyed this format. So let us know in the comments, wherever you get feedback. Thank you so much to Dr. Austin Baracki for joining me here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Again, this is Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number 6. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey everyone, it's me, Jordan from Barbell Medicine, and before we get into this podcast episode, I wanted to take this opportunity to tell you that this weekend only, we're running a special promotion for Father's Day. Take 20% off the entire site this weekend only using code DAD20 at checkout. We have our comprehensive training templates crafted by yours truly to help smash those goals, or you can check out our science-based supplements to help support your training and nutrition. All of our apparel is also on sale, so you can have the most nuanced wardrobe in the gym. Now, on a personal note, it is my birthday on June 17th. Yep, another year around the sun and another year with Barbell Medicine. Thank you so much for your support so far. We couldn't have done it without you. The sale ends after my birthday on June 17th. Again, use code DAD20, that's DAD20 at checkout to take 20% off site-wide. Discounts cannot be combined with other offers and other exclusions may apply.
A lot of smart people don't feel smart about their money. We have so many questions. Is a prenup a good way to start a marriage? Can I afford my dream home? And how do I leave a legacy for my children? Morgan Stanley has a podcast to help. On What Should I Do With My Money? You can listen in on real people asking the same questions you have and getting helpful answers from experienced financial advisors. Find and follow What Should I Do With My Money to get the answers you need to feel smart about your money.